Doomsday Book, Cassette 11.
The sermon should come next, if there was one. In most village churches, the priest only preached at the major masses, and even then it was usually no more than a catechism lesson, the listing of the seven deadly sins, or the seven acts of mercy. The high mass Christmas morning was probably when the sermon would be. But Father Roche stepped out in front of the central aisle, which had nearly closed up again as the villagers leaned against the pillars and each other, trying to find a more comfortable position, and began to speak. In the days when Christ came to earth from heaven, God sent signs that men might know his coming. And in the last days also will there be signs. There will be famines and pestilence, and Satan will ride abroad in the land. Oh no, Kivrin thought. Don't talk about seeing the devil riding a black horse. She glanced at Imani. The old woman looked furious, but it wouldn't matter what he'd said, Kivrin thought. She'd been determined to find mistakes and lapses she could tell the bishop about. Lady Evoldi looked mildly irritated, and everyone else had the look of tired patience people always get when listening to a sermon, no matter what the century. Kivrin had seen the same look in St. Mary's last Christmas. The sermon at St. Mary's had been on rubbish disposal, and the Dean of Christ Church had begun it by saying, "Christianity began in a stable. Will it end in a sewer?" But it hadn't mattered. It had been midnight, and St. Mary's had had a stone floor and a real altar, and when she closed her eyes, she'd been able to shut out the carpeted nave and the umbrellas and the laser candles. She had pushed the plastic kneeling pad out of her way and knelt on the stone floor and imagined what it would be like in the Middle Ages. Mr. Dunworthy had told her it wouldn't be like anything she had imagined, and he was right, of course, but not about this mass. She had imagined it just like this, the stone floor and the murmured Kyrie, the smells of incense and tallow and cold. The Lord will come with fire and pestilence, and all will perish, Roche said. But even in the last days, God's mercy will not forsake us. He will send us help and comfort and bring us safely unto heaven. Safely unto heaven, she thought of Mr. Dunworthy. Don't go, he had said. It won't be anything like you imagine. And he was right. He was always right. But even he, with all his imaginings of smallpox and cutthroats and witch burnings, would never have imagined this, that she was lost, that she didn't know where the drop was, and the rendezvous was less than a week away. She looked across the aisle at Garwin, who was watching Eloise. She had to talk to him after the mass. Father Roche moved to the altar to begin the mass proper. Agnes leaned against Kivrin, and Kivrin put her arm around her. Poor thing, she must be exhausted. Up since before dawn, and all that wild running around. She wondered how long the mass would take. The service at St. Mary's had taken an hour and a quarter, and halfway through the offertory, Dr. Aaron's bleeper had gone off. It's a baby, she'd whispered to Kivrin and Dunworthy as she'd hurried out. How appropriate. I wonder if they're in church now, she thought, and then remembered it wasn't Christmas there. They had had Christmas 3 days after she arrived, while she was still ill. It would be what? The 2nd of January. Christmas back nearly over, and all the decorations taken down. It was starting to get hot in the church, and the candles seemed to be taking all the air. She could hear shiftings and shufflings behind her as Father Roche went through the ritualized steps of the mass, and Agnes sank farther and farther against her. She was glad when they reached the Sanctus and she could kneel. She tried to imagine Oxford on the 2nd of January, the shops advertising New Year's sales, and the Carfax Carillon silent. Dr. Ahrens would be at the infirmary dealing with post-holiday stomach upsets, and Mr. Dunworthy would be getting ready for Hillary term. No, he's not, she thought, and saw him standing behind the thin glass. He's worrying about me. Father Roche raised the chalice, knelt, kissed the altar. There was more shuffling and a whispering on the men's side of the church. She looked across. Darwin was sitting back on his heels, looking bored. Sir Blowett was asleep. So was Agnes. She had collapsed so completely against Kivrin, there would be no way she could stand for the Paternoster. She didn't even try. When everyone else stood for it, Kivrin took the opportunity to gather Agnes in more closely and shift her head to a better position. Kivrin's knee hurt. She must have knelt in the depression between two stones. She shifted it, raising it slightly and cramming a fold of her cloak underneath it. Father Roche put a piece of bread in the chalice and said the Haec Commixtio, and everyone knelt for the Agnus Dei. Agnus Dei, qui tollis peccato mundi, miserere nobis, he chanted. Lamb of God, who takest away the sins of the world, have mercy upon us. Agnus Dei, Lamb of God. Kivrin smiled down at Agnes. She was sound asleep, her body a dead weight against Kivrin's side, and her mouth slackly open, but her fist was still clenched tightly over the little bell. My lamb, Kivrin thought. Kneeling on St. Mary's stone floor, she had envisioned the candles and the cold, but not Lady Imani, waiting for Roche to make a mistake in the mass. Not Eloise, or Garwin, or Rosamond. Not Father Roche with his cutthroat face and worn-out hose. She could never in 100 years, even in 734 years, have imagined Agnes, with her puppy and her naughty tantrums and her infected knee. I'm glad I came, she thought, in spite of everything. Father Roche made the sign of the cross with the chalice and drank it. Dominus vobiscum, he said, and there was a general commotion behind Kivrin. The main part of the show was over, and people were leaving now to avoid the crush. Apparently there was no deference to the Lord's family when it came to leaving, or even in waiting till they were outside to begin talking. She could scarcely hear the dismissal. Ite missa est, Father Roche said over the din, and Lady Imani was in the aisle before he could even lower his raised hand, looking like she intended to leave for Bath and the bishop immediately. Saw you the tallow candles by the altar, she said to Lady Ivaldi. I bade him use the beeswax candles that I gave him. Lady Ivaldi shook her head and looked darkly at Father Roche, and the two of them swept out with Rosamond right at their heels. Rosamond obviously had no intention of walking back to the manor with Sir Blowett if she could help it, and this should do it. The villagers had closed in behind the three women, talking and laughing. By the time he huffed and puffed his way to his feet, they would be all the way to the manor. Kivrin was having trouble getting up herself. Her foot had gone to sleep. And Agnes was dead to the world. Agnes, she said, wake up. It's time to go home. Sir Blowett had got to his feet, his face nearly purple with the effort, and had come across to offer Eloise his arm.
Your daughter has fallen asleep, he said.
Aye, Eloise said, glancing at Agnes. She took his arm, and they started out.
Your husband has not come, as he promised.
Nay, Kivrin heard Eloise say. Her grip tightened on his arm. Outside, the bells began to ring all at once, and out of time. A wild, irregular chiming. It sounded wonderful. Agnes, Kivrin said, shaking her, it's time to ring your bell. She didn't even stir. Kivrin tried to get the sleeping child onto her shoulder. Her arms flopped limply over Kivrin's shoulders, and the bell jangled. You waited all night to ring your bell, Kivrin said, getting to one knee. Wake up, lamb. She looked around for someone to help her. There was scarcely anyone left in the church. Cobb was making the rounds of the windows, pinching the candle flames out between his chapped fingers. Garwin and Sir Blowett's nephews were at the back of the nave, buckling on their swords. Father Roche was nowhere to be seen. She wondered if he was the one ringing the bell with such joyous enthusiasm. Her numb foot was beginning to tingle. She flexed it in the thin shoe, and then put her weight on it. It felt terrible, but she could stand on it. She hoisted Agnes further over her shoulder and tried to stand up. Her foot caught in the hem of her skirt, and she pitched forward. Garwin caught her.
Good Lady Catherine. My Lady Eloise bade me come to help you, he said, steadying her.
He lifted Agnes easily out of her arms and onto his shoulder, and strode out of the church, Kivrin hobbling beside him. Thank you, Kivrin said when they were out of the jammed churchyard. My arms felt like they were going to fall off.
Here's a stout lass, he said.
Agnes's bell slid off her wrist and fell onto the snow, clattering with the other bells as it fell. Kivrin stooped and picked it up. The knot was almost too small to be seen, and the short ends of ribbon beyond it were frayed into thin threads. But the moment she took hold of it, the knot came undone. She tied it on Agnes's dangling wrist with a little bow.
I am glad to assist a lady in distress,
Garwin said, but she didn't hear him. They were all alone on the green. The rest of the family was nearly to the manor gate. She could see the steward holding the lantern over Lady Imani and Lady Evaldi as they started into the passage. There were a lot of people still in the churchyard, and someone had built a bonfire next to the road, and people were standing around it, warming their hands and passing a wooden bowl of something. But here, halfway across the green, they were all alone. The opportunity she had thought would never come was here. I wanted to thank you for trying to find my attackers, and for rescuing me in the woods and bringing me here, she said. When you found me, how far from here was the place? Could you take me to it? He stopped and looked at her.
Did they not tell you? He said. All of your goods and gear that were found, I brought to the manor. The thieves had taken your belongings, and though I rode after them, I fear I found naught.
He started walking again. I know you brought my boxes here, thank you. But that wasn't why I wanted to see the place you found me, Kivrin said rapidly, afraid they would catch up with the others before she finished asking him. Lady Imani had stopped and was looking back their way. She had to get it asked before Imani sent the steward back to see what was keeping them. I lost my memory when I was injured in the attack, she said. I thought if I could see the place where you found me, I might remember something. He had stopped again and was looking at the road above the church. There were lights there, bobbing unsteadily and coming rapidly nearer. Latecomers to church? You're the only one who knows where the place is, Kivrin said. Or I wouldn't bother you. But if you could just tell me where it is, I could...
There is nothing there, he said vaguely, still looking at the lights. I brought your wagon and your boxes to the manor.
I know, Kivrin said, and I thank you, but...
They are in the barn, he said.
He turned at the sound of horses. The bobbing lights were lanterns carried by men on horseback. They galloped past the church and through the village, at least a half dozen of them, and pulled up short where Lady Eloise and the others were standing. It's her husband, Kivrin thought. But before she could finish her thought, Garwin had thrust Agnes into her arms and taken off toward them, pulling his sword as he ran. Oh, no, Kivrin thought, and began to run too, clumsy under Agnes's weight. It wasn't her husband. It was the men who were after them. The reason they were hiding. The reason Eloise had been so angry at Hermione for telling Sir Bloat they were here. The men with the torches had got down off their horses. Eloise walked forward to one of the three men still on horseback, and then fell to her knees as if she'd been struck. No. Oh, no, Kivrin thought, out of breath. Agnes's bell jangled wildly as she ran. Garwin ran up to them, his sword flashing in the lantern light, and then he was on his knees too. Eloise stood up and stepped forward to the men on horseback, her arm out in a gesture of welcome. Kivrin stopped, out of breath. The Bloat came forward, knelt, stood up. The men on horseback flung back their hoods. They were wearing hats of some kind, or crowns. Garwin, still on his knees, sheathed his sword. One of the men on horseback raised his hand, and something glittered.
What is it?
Agnes said sleepily.
I don't know,
Kivrin said. Agnes twisted around in Kivrin's arms so she could see.
It is the Three Kings,
she said, wonderingly. Transcript from the Doomsday Book. Christmas Eve, 1320, Old Style. An envoy from the bishop has arrived, along with two other churchmen. They rode in just after midnight mass. Lady Hermione is delighted. She's convinced they've come in response to her message demanding a new chaplain, but I'm not convinced of that. They've come without any servants, and there's an air of nervousness about them, as if they were on some secret, hurried mission. It has to concern Lord Guillaume, though the Assizes are a secular court, not an ecclesiastical one. Perhaps the bishop is a friend of Lord Guillaume's, or of King Edward II's, and they've come to strike some sort of deal with Eloise for his freedom. Whatever their reason for being here. They're here in style. Agnes thought they were the three magi when she first saw them, and they do look like royalty. The bishop's envoy has a thin, aristocratic face, and they are all dressed like kings. One of them has a purple velvet cloak with the design of a white cross sewn in silk on the back of it. Lady Hermione immediately latched onto him with her sad story of how ignorant, clumsy, generally impossible Father Roche is. He deserves not a parish, she said. Unfortunately, and luckily for Father Roche, he was not the envoy, but only his clerk. The envoy was the one in the red, also very impressive, with gold embroidery and a sable hem. The third is a Cistercian monk. At least he wears the white habit of one, though it's made of even finer wool than my cloak, and has a silk cord for a sash, and he wears a ring fit for a king on each of his fat fingers. But he doesn't act like a monk. He and the envoy both demanded wine before they'd even dismounted, and it's obvious the clerk had already drunk a good deal before he got here. He slipped just now getting off his horse, and had to be supported into the hall by the fat monk. Break. I was apparently wrong about the reason for their coming here. Eloise and Sir Bloat went off in a corner with the bishop's envoy as soon as they got in the house, but they only talked to him for a few minutes, and I just heard her tell Hermione, "They have heard naught of Guillaume." Hermione didn't seem surprised or even particularly concerned at this news. It's clear she thinks they're here to bring her a new chaplain, and she's falling all over them, insisting that the Christmas feast be brought in immediately, and that the bishop's envoy sit in the high seat. They seem more interested in drinking than in eating. Hermione fetched some cups of wine herself, and they've already gone through them and called for more. The clerk caught hold of Maisry's skirt as she brought the pitcher, pulled her in hand over hand, and stuck his hand down her shift. She, of course, clapped her hands over her ears. The one good thing about them being here is that they add tremendously to the general confusion. I only had a moment to talk to Garwin, but sometime in the next day or so, I'll surely be able to speak to him without anyone noticing. Especially since Hermione's attention is riveted on the envoy, who just grabbed the pitcher from Maisley and poured his wine himself. And get him to show me where the drop is. There's plenty of time. I have nearly a week. Chapter 21. Two more people died on the 28th. Both of them primaries who had been at the dance in Headington, and Latimer had a stroke. He developed myocarditis, which caused a thromboembolism, Mary had said when she phoned. At this point, he's completely unresponsive. Over half of Dunworthy's detainees were down with the flu, and there was only room in infirmary for the most severe cases. Dunworthy and Finch, and a detainee William had found, who'd had a year of nurse's training, gave temps and dispensed orange juice around the clock. Dunworthy made up cots and gave medications. And worried. When he had told Mary about Badri's saying, "That can't be right," of his saying, "It was the rat," she had said, "It's the fever, James. It has no connection with reality. I've one patient who keeps talking about the Queen's elephants." But he could not get the idea of Kivrin's being in 1348 out of his mind. What year is it? Badri had said that first night, and that can't be right. Dunworthy had telephoned Andrews after his argument with Gilchrist and told him he couldn't get access to Brazenose's net. "It doesn't matter," Andrews had said. "The locational coordinates aren't as critical as the temporals. I'll get an L&L on the dig from Jesus. I've already talked to them about doing the parameter checks, and they said it's all right." The visuals had been off again, but he had sounded nervous, as if he were afraid Dunworthy would broach the subject again of his coming to Oxford. "I've done some research on slippage," he said. "There are no theoretical limits, but in practice, the minimal slippage is always greater than zero, even in uninhabited areas. Maximal slippage has never gone above 5 years, and those were all unmanned. The greatest slippage on a manned drop was a 17th century remote, 226 days. "Is there anything else it could be?" Dunworthy had asked. "Anything besides the slippage that could go wrong?" "If the coordinates are correct, nothing," Andrews had said, and promised to report as soon as he'd done the parameter checks. 5 years was 1325. The plague had not even begun in China then, and Badri had told Gilchrist there was minimal slippage. And it couldn't be the coordinates. Badri had checked them before he fell ill. But the fear continued to nag at him, and he spent the few free moments he could snatch telephoning Tex, trying to find someone willing to come read the fix when the sequencing arrived and Gilchrist opened the laboratory again. It was supposed to have arrived yesterday, but when Mary phoned, she had still been waiting for it. She phoned again in the late afternoon. "Can you set up a ward?" she asked. The visuals were back on. Her SPGs looked like she'd slept in them, and her mask dangled from her neck by one tie. "I've already set up a ward," he said, "full of detainees. We've got 31 cases as of this afternoon." "Do you have space to set up another one?" "I don't need it yet," she said tiredly, "but at this rate I will. We're nearly at capacity here, and several of the staff are either down with it or are refusing to come in."
"And the sequencing hasn't come yet?"
he asked. "No. The WIC just phoned. They got a faulty result the first time through and had to run it again. It's supposed to be here tomorrow. Now they think it's a Uruguayan virus." She smiled wanly.
Badri hasn't been in contact with anyone from Uruguay, has he? How soon can you have the beds ready?
By this evening,
Dunworthy said. But Finch informed him they were nearly out of folding cots, and he had to go to the NHS and argue them out of a dozen. They didn't get the ward set up in two of the fellows' teaching rooms until morning. Finch, helping assemble the cots and make beds, announced that they were nearly out of clean linens, face masks, and lavatory paper. We haven't enough for the detainees, he said, tucking in a sheet, let alone all these patients, and we have no bandages at all.
It's not a war, Dunworthy said. I doubt if there'll be any wounded. Did you find out if any of the other colleges has a tech here in Oxford?
Yes, sir. I telephoned all of them, but none of them did. He tucked a pillow beneath his chin. I posted notices asking that everyone conserve laboratory paper, but it's done no good at all. The Americans are particularly wasteful. He tugged the pillow slip up over the pillow. I do feel rather sorry for them, though. Helen came down with it last night, you know, and they haven't any alternates.
Helen?
Miss Piantini, the tenor? She has a fever of 39.7. The Americans won't be able to do their Chicago surprise.
Which is probably a blessing, Dunworthy thought. Ask them if they'll continue to keep watch on my telephone, even if they're no longer practicing, he said. I'm expecting several important calls. Did Andrews ring back?
No, sir, not yet. And the visual is off. He plumped the pillow. It is too bad about the peel. They could do Stedman's, of course, but that's old hat. It does seem a pity there's no alternative solution.
Did you get the list of techs?
Yes, sir, Finch said, struggling with a reluctant cot. He motioned with his head. It's there by the chalkboard. Dunworthy picked up the sheets of paper and looked at the one on top. It was filled with columns of numbers, all of them with the digits 1 through 6 in varying order. That's not it, Finch said, snatching the papers away. Those are the changes for the Chicago surprise. He handed Dunworthy a single sheet. Here it is. I've listed the techs by college with addresses and telephone numbers. Colin came in, wearing his wet jacket and carrying a roll of tape and a plastine-covered bundle. The vicar says I'm to put these up in all the wards, he said, taking out a placard that read, Feeling disoriented, muddled, mental confusion can be a warning sign of the flu. He tore off a strip of tape and stuck the placard to the chalkboard. I was just posting these at the infirmary, and what do you think the gallstone was doing? He said, taking another placard out of the bundle. It read, Wear your face mask. He taped it to the wall above the cot Finch was making up. Reading the Bible to the patients. He pocketed the tape. I hope I don't catch it. He tucked the rest of the placards under his arm and started out.
Wear your face mask, Dunworthy said.
Colin grinned. That's what the gallstone said, and she said the Lord would smite anyone who heeded not the words of the righteous. He pulled the grey plaid muffler out of his pocket. I wear this instead of a face mask, he said, tying it over his mouth and nose, highwayman fashion.
Cloth cannot keep out microscopic viruses, Dunworthy said.
I know, it's a colour. It frightens them away. He darted out. Dunworthy rang Mary to tell her the ward was ready but couldn't get through, so he went over to infirmary. The rain had let up a little, and people mostly wearing masks were out again, coming back from the grocers and queuing in front of the chemist. But the streets seemed hushed, unnaturally silent.
Someone's turned the carillon off, Dunworthy thought. He almost regretted it.
Mary was in her office staring at a screen. The sequencing's arrived, she said, before he could tell her about the ward.
Who told Gilchrist?
He said eagerly.
No, she said. It's not the Uruguay virus, or the South Carolina.
What is it?
It's an H9N2.
Both the South Carolina and the Uruguay were H3s.
And where did it come from?
WIC doesn't know.
Not a known virus. It's previously unsequenced.
She handed him a printout. It has a 7-point mutation, which explains why it's killing people.
He looked at the printout. It was covered with columns of numbers like Finch's list of changes and as unintelligible.
It has to come from somewhere. Not necessarily. Approximately every 10 years there's a major antigenic shift with epidemic potential, so it may have originated with Badri.
She took the printout back from him.
Does he live around livestock, do you know?
Livestock? He said.
He lives in a flat in Headington. Mutant strains are sometimes produced by the intersection of an avian virus with a human strain. The WIC wants us to check possible avian contacts and exposure to radiation. Viral mutations have sometimes been caused by X-rays.
She studied the printout as though it made sense.
It's an unusual mutation. There's no recombination of the hemagglutinin genes. Only an extremely large point mutation.
No wonder she had not told Gilchrist. He had said he would open the laboratory when the sequencing arrived. But this news would only convince him he should keep it closed.
Is there a cure?
There will be as soon as an analogue can be manufactured and a vaccine. They've already begun work on the prototype.
How long?
3 to 5 days to produce a prototype, then at least another 5 to manufacture, if they don't run into any difficulty with duplicating the proteins. We should be able to begin inoculating by the 10th.
The 10th?
And that was when they could begin giving immunizations. How long would it take to immunize the quarantine area? A week? 2? Before Gilchrist and the idiot protesters considered it safe to open the laboratory.
That's too long, Dunworthy said.
I know, Mary said and sighed. God knows how many cases we'll have by then. There have been 20 new ones already this morning.
Do you think it's a mutant strain?
Dunworthy asked. She thought about it. No. I think it's much more likely that Badri caught it from someone at that dance in Headington. There may have been new Hindus there, or earthers, or someone else who doesn't believe in antivirals or modern medicine. The Canadian goose flu of 2010, if you'll remember, was traced back to a Christian Science commune. There's a source. We'll find it.
And what about Kivrin in the meantime? What if you don't find the source by the rendezvous? Kivrin's supposed to come back on the 6th of January. Will you have it sourced by then?
I don't know,
she said wearily.
She may not want to come back to a century that's rapidly becoming a 10. She may want to stay in 1320.
If she's in 1320,
he thought,
and went up to see Badri. He had not mentioned rats since Christmas night. He was back to the afternoon at Balliol when he had come looking for Dunworthy.
Laboratory,
he murmured when he saw Dunworthy. He tried feebly to hand him a note, and then seemed to sink into sleep, exhausted by the effort.
Dunworthy stayed only a few minutes, and then went to see Gilchrist. It was raining hard again by the time he reached Brasenose. The gaggle of picketers were huddling underneath their banners, shivering. The porter was standing at the lodge desk, taking the decorations off the little Christmas tree. He glanced up at Dunworthy and looked suddenly alarmed. Dunworthy walked past him and through the gate.
"You can't go in there, Mr. Dunworthy," the porter called after him. "The college is restricted."
Dunworthy walked into the quad. Gilchrist's rooms were in the building behind the laboratory. He hurried toward them, expecting the porter to catch up to him and try to stop him. The laboratory had a large yellow sign on it that read, "No admittance without authorization," and an electronic alarm attached to the door jamb.
"Mr. Dunworthy,"
Gilchrist said, striding toward him through the rain. The porter must have phoned him.
"The laboratory is off limits."
"I came to see you,"
Dunworthy said. The porter came up, trailing a tinsel garland.
"Shall I phone for the university police?" he asked.
"That won't be necessary. Come up to my rooms,"
he said to Dunworthy.
"I have something I want you to see."
He led Dunworthy into his office, sat down at his cluttered desk, and put on an elaborate mask with some sort of filters.
"I've just spoken to the WIC, he said.
His voice sounded hollow, as if it were coming from a great distance.
"The virus is a previously unsequenced virus whose source is unknown."
"It's been sequenced now," Dunworthy said. "And the analogue and vaccine are due to arrive in a few days. Dr. Ahrens has arranged for Brasenose to be given immunization priority, and I'm attempting to locate a tech who can read the fix as soon as immunization has been completed."
"I'm afraid that's impossible," Gilchrist said, hollowly. "I've been conducting research into the incidence of influenza in the 1300s. There are clear indications that a series of influenza epidemics in the first half of the 14th century severely weakened the populace, thereby lowering their resistance in the Black Death."
He picked up an ancient-looking book.
"I have found 6 separate references to outbreaks between October of 1318 and February of 1321.
He held up a book and began to read.
"After the harvest, there came upon all of Dorset a fever so fierce as to leave many dead. This fever began with an aching in the head and confusion in all the parts. The doctors bled them, but many died in despite."
A fever. In an age of fevers, typhoid and cholera and measles, all of them producing aching of the head and confusion in all the parts.
1319. The Bath assizes for the previous year were cancelled,"
Gilchrist said, holding up another book.
"A malady of the chest that fell upon the court so that none, nor judge, nor jury were left to hear the cases,"
Gilchrist said. He looked at Dunworthy over the mask.
"You stated that the public's fears over the net were hysterical and unfounded. It would seem, however, that they are based in solid historical fact."
Solid historical fact. References to fevers and maladies of the chest that could be anything, blood poisoning or typhus, or any of 100 nameless infections, all of which was beside the point. "The virus cannot have come through the net," he said.
"Drops have been made to the pandemic, to World War I battles in which mustard gas was used, to Tel Aviv. 20th century sent detection equipment to the site of St. Paul's 2 days after the pinpoint was dropped. Nothing comes through."
"So you say?"
He held up a printout.
"Probability indicates a 0.003% possibility of a microorganism being transmitted through the net,
and a 22.1% chance of a viable mix of virus being within the critical area when the net was opened.
Where in God's name do you get these figures? Dunworthy said. Pull them out of a hat? According to probability, he said, putting a nasty emphasis on the word, there was only a 0.04% chance of anyone's being present when Kivrin went through. A possibility you consider statistically insignificant.
Viruses are exceptionally sturdy organisms, Gilchrist said. They have been known to lie dormant for long periods of time, exposed to extremes of temperature and humidity, and still be viable. Under certain conditions, they form crystals, which retain their structure indefinitely. When put back into solution, they become infective again. Viable tobacco mosaic crystals have been found dating from the 16th century. There is clearly a significant risk of the viruses penetrating the net if opened, and under the circumstances, I cannot possibly allow the net to be opened.
The virus cannot have come through the net, Dunworthy said.
Then why are you so anxious to have the fix read?
Because, Dunworthy said, and stopped to get control of himself. Because reading the fix will tell us whether the drop went as planned or whether something went wrong.
Oh, you'll admit there's a possibility of error then, Gilchrist said. Then why not an error that would allow a virus through the net? As long as that possibility exists, the laboratory will remain locked. I'm certain Mr. Basingham will approve of the course of action I've taken.
Basingham, Dunworthy thought. That's what this is all about. It has nothing to do with the virus or the protesters or maladies of the chest in 1318. This is all to justify himself to Basingham. Gilchrist was acting head in Basingham's absence, and he had rushed through the re-ranking. Rushed through a drop, intending no doubt to present Basingham with a brilliant fait accompli. But he hadn't got it. Instead, he'd got an epidemic, and a lost historian, and people picketing the college, and now all he cared about was vindicating his actions, saving himself even though it meant sacrificing Kivrin.
What about Kivrin? Does Kivrin approve of your course of action? He said. Miss Engel was fully aware of the risks when she volunteered to go to 1320, Gilchrist said.
Was she aware you intended to abandon her?
This conversation is over, Mr. Dunworthy.
Gilchrist stood up.
I will open the laboratory when the virus has been sourced. And it has been proven to my satisfaction that there is no chance it came through the net.
He showed Dunworthy to the door. The porter was waiting outside.
I have no intention of allowing you to abandon Kivrin, Dunworthy said. Gilchrist crimped his lips under the mask. And I have no intention of allowing you to endanger the health of this community.
He turned to the porter.
Escort Mr. Dunworthy to the gate. If he attempts to enter Brazenose again, telephone the police.
He slammed the door.
This ends side 1 of cassette 11. Please turn the cassette over and start side 2 at the same point.